You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of November 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson and coming up in today's programme. Huge celebrations in Harare as Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe's president of 37 years, resigns. We'll have the latest from the Zimbabwean capital to hear about the demise of an era many said would never end. Also ahead, would a minority government for Angela Merkel's CDU party be such a terrible thing for Germany? Plus, we find out what de-ranking means and why it's bad news for Russia's journalists. And why do pasta, sun and la dolce vita become a valid measure of a country's success? Well, we'll find out why the Italians think so, at least. That's all ahead on The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. First, a quick recap of the day's headlines. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has resigned. The announcement came as lawmakers debated an impeachment motion against the 93-year-old leader in the country's parliament. Mr. Mugabe had previously refused to step down despite last week's military takeover. We'll have much more on this in just a moment as we cross live to Harare for the latest on the celebrations there. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has called for a political settlement in Syria. His comments come amid an unannounced visit to Russia by the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Russian leader stressed there is a need to reach a solution to Syria's entrenched civil war. The US Department of Justice has filed a lawsuit to block the telecoms giant AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner. The department said the merger would reduce competition and lead to higher consumer prices. AT&T has said it will fight the move as it's a radical departure from US competition practice. And the Pope has said the police should have empathy for drivers who are caught speeding. Pope Francis, who is speaking at a meeting of traffic officers in Italy, said mercy should be shown towards those who break the rules of the road. He added that police should also seek to understand why a person has committed an offence. Those are your headlines. We head to Zimbabwe first, where they are already talking about their future. Because after 37 years as their leader, Robert Mugabe resigned as president of Zimbabwe earlier. The celebrations are expected to continue long into the night, with scenes of people embracing the members of the military who until just last week were Mugabe's enforcers. Well, a little earlier, I spoke to Eddie Cross, an MP for Zimbabwe's main opposition party. He was in the parliamentary chamber when the speaker broke the news of Mugabe's resignation. I asked Eddie what it was like to be part of such a moment.
You know, we all have those moments in our lives when we can remember exactly where we were and what we were doing at the time that an event happened. You know, I remember when the planes went into the World Trade Center in New York, and I can remember exactly, and I remember walking into a room and turning on the TV and just standing there and being absolutely gobsmacked. I remember when Kennedy was shot. Well, yesterday was a bit like that. You know, after 37 years of Robert Gabriel Mugabe, suddenly he's gone. And the roar in the chamber when it was announced that we had received his resignation was just the start of a massive street party. I don't think the country will go to work tomorrow. I think they're all going to be hungover, and some of them will still be partying.
Tell us a little bit more about the last 48 hours and how that has been for you, given the fact that there was that surprise nearly announcement that he was going to stand down, and then the resignation speech that never was, and then the impeachment proceedings that had to take place. Did anybody ever expect Robert Mugabe to go quietly?
No, we didn't. It wasn't even on our horizon. I mean, 2 weeks ago, we could have never believed that this would have happened. And it's happened so fast and so seamlessly. It's really been extraordinary, almost as if God had a hand in it. the country breathes a huge sigh of relief. You know, we've lived under the thumb of this man now for so long that to imagine Zimbabwe without him has almost seemed impossible. My own feeling was a bit mixed. I actually felt that he deserved better than to be metaphorically dragged through the streets of Harare with people trying to stand on him. You know, this is the man who fought a long guerrilla war against white colonial rule. This is the man who negotiated our independence in 1980. This is the man who gave Zimbabweans their independence and their freedom, and frankly, gave them dignity.
But Eddie, he gave Zimbabwe, and you know this more than anybody, he drove the economy into the ground. He exerted yes. despotic rule. You stand yeah. in an opposition party that has not had the opportunity to be just that, an opposition party, and now the country needs to rebuild. How does yes. it go about doing that when the main candidate likely to take over as president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has presided over economic ruin as Mugabe's deputy and has the reputation of such a harsh reputation that people call him the crocodile?
Yes, Emmerson has a huge mountain to climb. I think he'll be probably sworn in tomorrow. They're certainly getting a move on this whole operation. And over the weekend, he's got to form a new cabinet. The illustration I've used to try and describe what's happened here is that he's been trying to catch this particular bus for about 5 years. He's now caught the bus. He's pulled the driver, who's a geriatric 93-year-old, out of the driver's seat and dumped him on the ground and taken over his seat just to discover that this wretched bus has no wheels and no diesel. And I think that's going to be his problem. The country is in a catastrophic state economically. And frankly, socially and politically. We've been under a military junta for 20 years. The military are not going to go back to barracks very easily. They might physically go back to barracks, but they're going to remain influential, even crucial to any decision-making in the future. They're going to want a role in the state, much like Myanmar with Aung San Suu Kyi. And we know how uncomfortable that can be. So Emmerson has a massive job to do. He has two priorities. He has to repair his political relationship with the international community. And the international community is not going to give him an easy ride. You're getting a tough struggle over Brexit from Europe. Europe is being very hard-nosed with Britain. Well, let me tell you, it'll be the same situation with the international community and Emmerson Mnangagwa. They're going to demand that he clearly sets out a roadmap to a free and fair election. They're going to demand that he restores all human and political rights.
And what about the military? They are the ones, ultimately, who we must remember, they started this whole procedure a week ago. Had the military not decided that enough was enough, we wouldn't be in this situation today. They will certainly want something from this.
No doubt about that. You know, change in a dictatorship like ours, and any dictatorship around the world, requires a considerable amount of force. In the case of Ian Douglas Smith in Rhodesian days, 1976, it was Henry Kissinger who came with American power. In the case of South Africa in 94, it was Mrs. Thatcher who used her influence with the rest of the world to put an enormous pressure on South Africa to change. And really, South Africa had no alternative but to adopt the changes that thereafter followed. Here, nobody was prepared to use whatever power they had to influence the events here. We were really on our own. And therefore, there was little alternative but for our army to perform that function, which they've done. And they've done it very professionally. I think we've got to be proud of them. The problem I have is that in 2008, when Morgan Tsvangirai won the election by a big margin, 54% to 27%, which anywhere in the world would be a rollover, the army went to Mugabe and said, no way, we're not accepting that. And they forced a runoff, and then the rest is history. So the army here is hugely influential. And it will be increasingly so now that they've succeeded in overthrowing Robert Mugabe. that's going to be a huge task for the incoming president. But he's the one man who can ride the tiger.
Eddie Cross, Thank you for joining us on the line from Harare.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. We're live from Studio One at Midori House in London, where the time in Germany is 23:11, here in London 22:11. The collapse of the coalition talks have posed the greatest threat to Angela Merkel's position as Germany's Chancellor, they say. This afternoon, the country's president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, urged party leaders to get back round the table and start talking again. The other two options, a minority government of Angela Merkel's CDU party or snap elections, haven't been ruled out. Well, Stephanie Boltzen is a London correspondent for Die Welt and joins us on the line now. Stephanie, welcome to Monocle 24. And I'm also joined in the studio by John McTernan, Tony Blair's Director of Political Operations, and also formerly Julia Gillard's Director of Communications, a man who knows what to do when a politician is in a tight spot. Stephanie, I mean, how much of a difficult situation is Angela Merkel in at the moment? Is it a catastrophe if the other leaders won't come to an agreement with her?
No, I don't think it is a complete catastrophe. Of course, obviously, the situation in Germany is very difficult, and it is so because this is something Germans have not been used to. We have a tradition of coalition governments, and there were sometimes after elections talk of 1 week or 2 weeks or even 4 weeks, but then a coalition would be built. Now is the first time that a coalition preliminary talks even have broken down, and that's something, of course, there's something new for Germany. It's something historic in a way, but in a way it's also something that is happening all over Europe. I think looking at the reactions outside Germany, they are far more catastrophic than they are inside Germany. So I wouldn't, obviously what is true is that Angela Merkel is on the decline, but that was already clear after the elections back in September when she pulled an historically bad result for her party.
Do you agree, John, exactly with Stephanie saying that this is not a catastrophe, but it is a grave problem for Angela Merkel, given her weakened position when she came out of her elections?
Look, I think it's an important point to say. Every European country has fragmenting politics, fragmenting political parties and support for the main parties. That's a reality. Angela Merkel remains a dominant politician because of her experience and because of her clear view about not just Germany, but about Europe. Because the negotiations are going badly for her at the moment, but you can't say that the FDP or the Greens or the Social Democrats in Germany have a different view on how Germany should be. When there's a conflict about the different way your country could be run, then you have real deep-seated conflict. So I think, Angela Merkel took a hit in that election, but her authority as the senior leading European politician remains the same. And nobody in Britain should be trying to make anything out of this, because the European Union, the EU27, have decided how they're going to talk to Britain. It doesn't depend on one person, it's on 27 countries.
Indeed, I mean, the way that the Frau Merkel has sort of carried herself, Stephanie, in the last couple of days has been astonishing. When she emerged yesterday to say that there has been a moment of soul-searching, you almost felt comforted by it for some reason. She still carried that authority. And not for one minute did we think that there was anything to be worried about.
I do agree in part. I mean, what is true is that she gave that interview yesterday in the German state television, and she was very calm. She said, "I have not been asked to resign. I have won the election. I'm the person to build a new coalition." But of course, as I said before, there is certain uneasiness in Germany now about this situation. But again, as John said before, I mean, she's been around now for 12 years as a chancellor. She has managed quite some big crises like the euro crisis, the refugee crisis. She's still there. And she has an enormous authority. People do still trust her. And what was interesting, not really surprising, but the CDU party immediately closed ranks around her and said she's the one who's going to lead the party out of this difficult situation.
It is an unusual thing. Every time I do an interview about German politics, it's almost as if Angela Merkel is the political mecca. All political roads lead to Angela Merkel. If she had not been in the centre of all these negotiations in the last couple of days, for example, I mean, this is an entirely hypothetical situation, but had Angela Merkel not been part of these negotiations, John, what kind of argument, what kind of Germany would we be looking at at the moment, given the fact that the political spectrum from which they're drawing the arguments now is so broad?
Look, I think the strength that Angela Merkel brings is she is a centrist and dominates from the centre-right. If she wasn't there, then I think the SPD, the second party, the second biggest party in Germany, would be filling that role. They'd be saying Germany needs to be run from the centre. That you can look at the AfD and the rise of the extreme right through the AfD, but in the end, the German people voted for some form of coalition, whether it is the Jamaica coalition, where a conservative aligns with the Green Party, which is inconceivable in Britain, inconceivable, I think, in Australia, inconceivable to a lot of the listeners to this show, or whether it is conservatives aligning with progressives, with the, you know, so as it would be Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn in the UK, inconceivable too. The German settlement is that by and large they have to work together. The political parties have to work together, and it's in the interest of Germany for that to happen, but actually the interest of Europe for that to happen. Nobody in Germany is going to take advantage of this situation to take authority from Angela Merkel, because the negotiations that the EU27, led by Germany and France, but all the 27, with Britain over Brexit, are so important to every country in Europe. No one's going to take advantage of her in the way that nobody in her party is going to try and take advantage of her.
Indeed, Stephanie, Wolfgang Schäuble, President of the German Parliament, has actually gone as far as to say Europe and many other states in the world are waiting for us. I mean, how often do you get countries who realise that an external judgment awaits when you're dealing with your internal politics? How much do you think that is a factor in their negotiations internally?
I think there is a very broad awareness of the role Germany has within Europe, and there's also a very mature debate about the responsibility you got. So you see that from Wolfgang Schäuble, and by the way, Wolfgang Schäuble is an interesting person also because he now took the job of the president of the parliament. He was, as many people know, for many years the finance minister. He was hated and loved for that, loved in Germany, hated outside Germany. But he took on this role, though he's, he could, it was said he would like to stay in the cabinet, but he took on this role because he knew that the German parliament, because of the AfD, the right-wing party, now joining the parliament with 94 MPs, this is going to be a new parliament. And he assumed the responsibility to moderate and to host this parliament. And actually his first appearance, because that was already inaugurated, the parliament, was really impressive. So that is not to be complacent at all. I mean, the AfD is a real danger in Germany, and there are many things going on in Germany that are very difficult. But I'm kind of optimistic that there is a big democratic maturity in this country.
Let's talk about democratic maturity, John, as we move to the United Kingdom. Many people have been suggesting, it has been suggested in the past, however, that you can have, no matter what the United Kingdom may offer on the table in Brussels, there is no way that Germany will allow Britain to have a bad Brexit. Would you argue that that's a slight over-reliance on Angela Merkel and her ability to save the day?
I think a lot of people in Britain don't want to confront the reality of Brexit. We have chosen, as a country, to leave the European Union. While we were spending time talking to ourselves about what that meant, the EU27 all agreed together. It's not Angela Merkel, it's not Macron, it's not the Irish government. The EU27 have agreed. Britain wants to leave, fair enough. Britain has to agree on money, which can be done. Britain has to agree on EU citizens living in Britain, that can be done. Britain has to agree on the future of Northern Ireland and the border of Northern Ireland. This has been explicit for a very long time. There is no get-out clause. Angela Merkel is not going to save the UK from its own decisions. Angela Merkel will not save Theresa May from her stupid decision to say we'll leave the customs union and we'll leave the single market. It is the British government who've chosen to define the terms of Brexit, not Angela Merkel. And the British government have to solve the problem of Brexit, not Angela Merkel or any other European leader.
Very briefly, there's been quite a lot of discussion about Brexit. Someone saying that Brexit could actually work with a different team in charge. What would you say?
My own view personally is that Brexit can never work. It's a disaster. And I think that if the Conservative government changed the team, they would fall. There'd be an election. And I think if the Labour Party came into power through an election or through the collapse of the Tory government, it would all be because Brexit would be falling around everybody's ears. So I think we have this lot, and their view is, Theresa May's view, as articulated, really is crash or crash through. My own view is we'll crash.
John McTernan, on that note, thank you very much indeed. My thanks also to Stephanie Botson from Die Welt. You're listening to Monocle 24. In a moment, why Google wants to rearrange your news. A relatively new verb has been doing the rounds in the mainstream media's vernacular today. Google has, I open quotation marks, deranked Russian media outlets such as Russia Today and Sputnik, companies that, according to Google, are responsible for the spread of Russian propaganda. Well, Josh Coles is researcher in the ethics of data at the Alan Turing Institute. What an exotically wonderful job title you have, Josh. Welcome to the programme. So, deranking, what does that mean?
Well, I think what Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google, who made the suggestion, wants us to think is that it means we're going to sort of have our algorithms tweaked and we're going to see less news from Russia Today and Sputnik, these two Russian outlets which have been identified as spreading misinformation. Schmidt was very careful to talk about not wanting to censor news sources. And I think it's a noble aim, but I think the problem with that suggestion is that really, if you don't appear on Google as a news outlet, to some extent you are being censored. You know, every time a Google search algorithm runs, it's deciding what we do and don't see. And so much of our information comes from Google and from Facebook and other portals to the internet that really, if you don't appear on those services, to some extent you don't really exist online. That's a bit dramatic, but you know, if a tree falls in the forest. So I think the tightrope, and it really is a tightrope that Google and Facebook and these other platforms are walking right now, is on the one hand, they don't want to be accused of censorship or have the responsibility of deciding what isn't and isn't truthful. But on the other hand, they can't be seen to let the sort of thing which potentially happened in 2016 happen again.
Indeed. I mean, Mr. Schmidt said, I'm not in favour of censorship. Fair enough. I am, however, I'd love you to unpick this for us. I'm very strongly in favour of ranking. It's what we do. It's a very legitimate question as to how we rank A or B, right? And we do the best we can in millions and millions of rankings every day. That doesn't explain how they will rank or derank the Russian outlets, do they? I mean, are they going to be, you know, if on a on a, let's say Russia today is number one in the rankings. It's pushed up to the top of what Google lets you see when you do the search. Where are we going to find Russia today now? Are we going to find it at number 3, 4, 5, or 550,000?
Well, as it happens, just as I was doing a bit of research for this, I did search Eric Schmidt's name in Google, and clearly the change hasn't been implemented yet, because of the top three sources that I saw on the news site, Russia Today and Sputnik were two of the three sources who are actually covering this story, which I thought was quite ironic. But in the sense of what we mean by deranking, I think the simplest answer is that probably Eric Schmidt doesn't really know what Google will do in the kind of secret source of that algorithm. And I suspect that very few people, even at Google necessarily, engineers, know that. The algorithm has got so big that the algorithm we use to search Google, a few things they could probably do more easily at the surface. I mean, these outlets were part of Google's news service, which is a curated list of news entities, titles. So that's kind of a more of a human level intervention, which says we think you are not news, and therefore you can appear on our service or not. But in general, I mean, it's particularly true with Facebook as well. There's so many signals and so many different data points coming into these algorithms that it's really tough at this point to extract one thing and say, okay, that's going to change the rankings. And then if we, you know, what's the price of being successful at that? Are we overreaching? I think the danger for overreach is really clear as well.
Indeed, overreach in terms of diplomacy, and insofar as the Russians recently have been saying that CNN could be seen as a foreign agent, that foreign journalists indeed will be classified as foreign agents when they operate within Russia. It has become a very obvious and clear tit-for-tat relationship now between Russia and the United States when it comes to coverage. Twitter's bans ads from Russia Today and Sputnik because of election interference, this, that and the other. It becomes a very obvious and very lame game, and you find yourself where no one wins here, do they?
No, I don't think so. And I think framing it in this sort of bipolar, almost Cold War setup of geopolitics is probably not particularly useful either. I mean, a lot of these platforms obviously appear in different countries under different guises. I mean, a while ago, Google was forced by a European court, or a French court at least, to implement what's the so-called right to be forgotten, whereby if people didn't want their name appearing in Google search results in connection to a particular embarrassing incident, maybe they would not appear. But at the time the ruling came out, all you had to do was go to google.com instead of google.fr, and you would see the results for that person showing up. So this whole concept of national sovereignty is, even that is quite tricky to unpack. Clearly, elections are probably a special case. We want to be particularly careful around elections to make sure that they're not interfered with. But in general, it's a really tricky thing to police across borders.
And in terms of national sovereignty, I mean, yeah, policing across borders, but who actually has the authority to do this? It becomes a very obvious and clear and clear cut affair when you know, Russia Today's bank accounts were closed last year. It was a government decision to do that, and NatWest chose the accounts, but it was after prompting from concerns from the Foreign Office. When you have the likes of a private enterprise such as Google, which decides who and who will not be exposed on its website, under whose authority is Google operating? Is it just Mr. Schmidt himself? Insofar as, at which point then we start working into the, we start sort of like pottering into the realm of who has the greater authority here? A sovereignty, a country, a government, or Mr. Schmidt?
Yeah, absolutely true. I mean, obviously, national governments still have, in some sense, they still have the ultimate sovereignty if they choose to use it, I guess. And the way that they would think about using it maybe would be in the context of regulation, defining Google or Facebook as public utilities and saying, look, this is like electricity. You know, this is the standard of communication we use in the same way that we have standards for electricity. And therefore, you need to be regulated, or you need to take on a really burdensome role of defining what content appears. And I don't think they want to do that either.
No, because, you know, in terms of law, let's take the law of defamation. There's a huge row going on the internet about whether something like Google or Facebook is a publisher or whether it's merely a distributor. It looks at the moment like Google is deciding that it wants to be a publisher. Do you think it's trying to define itself in one way to suit one purpose and another way to suit another?
I think that's probably a pretty fair interpretation, yeah. You know, they have really big profits to defend, really big bottom line considerations. I do think there's still something of a mission in at least some of these Silicon Valley companies. I think there's still somewhat of a desire to do the right thing, but I think the problem is that nobody really quite knows what the right thing to do is, except on a case-by-case basis and in response to media scandals or the latest story to hit.
And we'll find out soon enough what the Russians want to do in return. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. That was Josh Coles. The veteran US broadcaster Charlie Rose has been sacked by CBS News. The news anchor has been accused of sexual harassment by 8 women, as reported by the Washington Post. Rose has already been suspended by CBS, PBS and Bloomberg. Well, joining us for more is the New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker from Monocle 24. Ed, thank you for joining us. Explain to us what's happened with Charlie Rose then.
Indeed. As you were saying, you know, Charlie Rose is this sort of establishment figure in U.S. politics. You know, he's led this interview show on PBS, as close as the U.S. comes to a national TV broadcaster, for years, a sort of very serious long-form journalism with a black background. And then he's also the host, or has been until he was axed, of CBS's morning show. So kind of someone who is a household name for Americans, who is constantly on TV and has been famed for his serious journalism. You know, we suddenly have the axe coming down very quickly, happening today on his career, with the news, as you mentioned, that CBS News has decided to fire him, and one expects the same to go with PBS and Bloomberg, who have already said they will be dropping shows. So, as you said again, you know, the Washington Post revealing allegations of 8 women about his inappropriate behavior, about his advances, about him regularly sort of cavorting naked in front of them when they would come to his house, his beachside house in New York State. And also, one needs to add, the second sort of big, if you like, media story to emerge of this ongoing slew of sexual allegations that have enveloped the US. We also saw last night in breaking news that Glenn Thrush, the New York Times White House journalist, who kind of rose to prominence during those acrimonious White House press conferences, again accused of sexual misconduct or inappropriate behavior with a whole host of young women, as reported by Vox. So two, I guess, big stories that have rocked the media landscape here in the US. Charlie Rose, perhaps more so, just because he is that massive establishment figure that has been around for so many decades. You know, he's in his 70s. He's such an established figure. But still, two big names that have seemingly dropped over the last couple of days. And also two names, one might say, from the sort of left of the media landscape. It seems to be so far that these allegations are targeting or have targeted more people on the left. That could be a coincidence, or there may be more to it, but I wouldn't want to speculate too much on that.
Indeed. I mean, he has issued a very, very full apology. It's quite eye-popping, actually. It says, I pride myself on being an advocate for the careers of the women with whom I have worked. I always felt I was pursuing shared feelings, even though I now realise I was mistaken. And clearly, he must have thought those shared feelings with a very large amount of women. I mean, sharing love, it doesn't even begin to describe what he's accused of doing. But now that we have big scalps like this with Charlie Rose, more people are now saying, well, hang on a minute, aren't we going to start to go after Donald Trump?
I know that's the thing that I keep asking myself as well. It's truly baffling that Donald Trump is still not in this conversation. I honestly cannot believe it. Someone said to me today that, you know, it's about sex, but it's also about power. And obviously being president of the US affords you a huge amount of power. But even so, it seems to me utterly bizarre that he's not being talked about more. I think it's 8 women who raised allegations against him during the presidential election. It seems baffling that not only is this not resurfacing, or if it is, it's only resurfacing on the side compared to these other stories, but he doesn't seem afraid to wade into this discussion. He's been commenting on social media, for example, about the Democratic Senator Al Franken, who's accused of kissing against her will a woman back in 2006, and now a radio host when they were on tour when he was a comedian back then. And he's waded into that discussion and criticized Al Franken, and yet he's sort of, I wouldn't say praised Roy Moore, the Alabama politician who's standing for a Senate seat next month that has caused a sort of furore within the inner workings of the Republican Party. But he's also made public statements about there needing to be a Republican in that seat in Alabama, and currently the only person who would fill that seat in Alabama is Roy Moore. So baffling that Donald Trump, despite his checkered past, to say the least, and of course that recording that we have of him talking about grabbing women's genitals, he still thinks it's okay to wade into this argument, and he seems to feel that he's invincible. And I guess the tragic thing at the moment is, at the moment, he seems to be. The discussion about Donald Trump isn't happening, and we'll have to wait and see if the continued stories of this nature happen, whether finally that spotlight will be re-shone on Donald Trump, or if the power he wields will allow him to continue to deflect that.
Ed Stocker in New York, thank you. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. You're live on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 22:37. This is Emma Nelson. Joni Steiner is co-founder of OpenDesk. It's a new kind of furniture company that also operates as an online marketplace. Well, on tomorrow's edition of The Entrepreneurs, Monocle 24's programme dedicated to businesses, he'll be telling our Matt Alagaya all about it. And in this preview of the show, Joni explains to Matt how his idea first arrived while he was working as an architect.
OpenDesk is a new kind of furniture company that operates as an online marketplace. And it's really about disrupting and rethinking the 20th century model of supply chains and sort of manufacturing and shipping. It's very much about local manufacturing and focusing on furniture. It's furniture for creative, exciting workplaces. And it's designed by people all over the world, but it's crucially made as locally as possible to the person that is buying it or commissioning it.
And what were you doing before you started OpenDesk? I mean, were you working as an architect? Were you practicing as an architect here in London?
After studying, I studied at the Royal College of Art here in London. I mean, before that in Bath, I met a really interesting group of people who went on to start a design studio together. That studio still exists. It's called Zero Zero. And it was really a group of people who were like-minded in their kind of approach, if you like, to design and the world. So there's a nice quote, which is Bruce Mao saying he's more interested in the design of the world than the world of design. And I think that really kind of applied to us. You know, we were kind of inquisitive, curious, and from different backgrounds. So originally architects, but then a social geographer joined the team, a web developer, a researcher. As a group of people, we were interested in, as designers, what kind of impact can we have on the world? It was really around sort of social impact. And we got involved in quite a lot of interesting projects with some great clients, from sort of web platforms and research pieces through to full large buildings.
And where did the original idea for OpenDesk come from? Was there one moment that really, I guess, light bulb moment where you realized that this was, you know, a great idea that could also work as a business?
I have to be honest, the company started accidentally, I'd say. It was almost a happy accident. As designers, as architects, it was myself and the co-founder, Nick, who we studied architecture together. We started this design studio together, and we were just working on a specific project, which was for a really interesting company in Clerkenwell. They were themselves a startup, a digital agency called Mint Digital. Very interesting people who are designers themselves, and kind of challenged us as architects to rethink their studio. They just moved into a warehouse. Really, they had a limited budget. They had quite short kind of time to work on this project, and they wanted something kind of impactful. But crucially, they wanted something that really fitted the way they worked and sort of said something about them as a company. We didn't have a lot of time. We didn't have a lot of money. And we were working in this warehouse space, and became apparent that the furniture and the things that they would actually be surrounding themselves with and using would really form a big part of that space and how they would work. And we looked at things that were out there on the market, and we proposed lots of things, because there's a kind of rule that architects shouldn't really design furniture. I mean, you know, there's a lot of furniture in the world. We actually found that they challenged us to say, well, what about designing something for us that's also something that we can participate in the design of? You know, what about something that's made a bit sort of closer to us, maybe something made in London? So they actually really challenged us to think about that and look outside and see what was there. And that led us to sort of learning about a whole process of making, which is using digital tools. It's about distributing making, so we're able to make things in lots of locations. And it's about using great craftspeople, but crucially using existing kind of capacity, existing workshops, rather than setting up a factory or building things kind of thousands of miles away. It really led us into this whole world of designing in a new way. And then the crucial other part was that they had an office in New York as well as in London. So we designed a desk for them. We found a great local fabricator, a guy called Ian, just a few miles away in London. We learned a lot from him. We sort of hung out in his workshop. We designed this desk, which was very efficient use of material. It's made from wood. It's kind of sustainably sourced wood. It's cut with a machine that sort of cuts these parts out very efficiently, but then it's hand finished. And when we were then asked by Mint Digital to make the same furniture for their New York office, I think they expected us to basically make double the amount and ship it across the Atlantic. We said to them, well, you know, you're a digital agency. You, when you work across countries and continents, you know, you don't have to physically always be there. You can just sort of send things, obviously, digitally as well. So why don't we do the same? Why don't we find the equivalent of Ian in Brooklyn or somewhere in New York, send the designs across, and then make the desks for your New York office local to where it is?
That was Joni Steiner of Open Desk talking to Monocle's Matt Allegier. You can hear the full episode on The Entrepreneurs tomorrow at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. The archive is at monocle.com. Coming up, though, we review the Asian headlines. Carlo Bonura is standing by.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 6:44 a.m. in Beijing, 22:44 here in London. Time now to have a look at what's making the front pages in Asia. I'm delighted to say Carlo Bonora, Senior Teaching Fellow in Southeast Asian Politics at SOAS, brings us all the newspapers so you don't have to read them. Right, so welcome, Carlo. Where are we starting?
In Indonesia, there's a big development in a fairly large-scale corruption case that the Corruption Eradication Commission has been pursuing. This is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Setia Novanto, who has been arrested and will face trial in about 3 weeks from now. The case here is a fairly large one, not in terms of monetary value, but in terms of just the number of officials involved. So in under the previous administration, a couple of years ago, there was a over $400 million allocation to develop a new electronic card, ID card system for Indonesians. And just under half of that money, $174 million, went missing. The commission was interested in trying around 35 officials from across the government, and the one that they've been trying the hardest to get in front of a court is the Speaker of the House. This is the second time they've tried to arrest him. In terms of he was named as a suspect back in September in a pretrial motion. This was waived, and they finally got him now.
Why haven't we seen this reported more widely? It's something that I suspect might be sort of reasonably widely reported in the likes of Indonesia, but this is pretty new to the rest of the world, isn't it?
Pretty new to the rest of the world. The corruption scandal has been developing for, I think, the last year and a half. If you look at Southeast Asia more broadly, there are much, much larger corruption scandals. For instance, the 1MDB corruption scandal in Malaysia, where we're talking about close to $1 billion dollars is alleged to have ended up into the prime minister's bank account. So this is small in terms of its monetary value. But I think that the real story here, which has not been covered perhaps as widely as it should have, is that the Corruption Eradication Commission is, for all of Indonesia's faults, is the potentially the only truly autonomous anti-corruption commission in the region. If you look at the commission in Thailand, that's been a mess and completely politicized. So this is the real story here, I think.
Because how politicized is it?
In this case,
yes,
they have a level of autonomy which is unrivaled, perhaps except in Singapore, in terms of their authority. And the fact that the House of Representatives was trying to curtail their prosecutorial powers while the investigation into the Speaker was going on demonstrates how threatening the members of Parliament see this.
Okay, let's move on to Asian Correspondent. There's an article here where it says that China is offering a three-step solution to end Burma's Rohingya crisis.
Right. This is a very interesting piece. We usually don't see China playing this type of diplomatic role. They're not actually offering to mediate the crisis between Bangladesh and Myanmar or Burma, but actually simply offering a plan. The problem with the plan is that although it calls for a ceasefire, which is effectively, you know, a lot of the violence recently has been one-sided in terms of the Burmese military, and calling for more coordination between Burma and Bangladesh, which is already somewhat in process, it's calling for the development of Rakhine State. And at one point, the foreign minister, because this came out of a meeting of Asian foreign ministers, the Chinese foreign minister suggested that the root cause to this problem with the Rohingya and in Rakhine State is poverty, when in fact the root cause of the problem is citizenship. The Burmese government, the Myanmar government, simply does not recognize Rohingya as active citizens. And as long as this is in place, the crisis will be in place, particularly for those Rohingya who came who fled to Bangladesh and other parts of Asia prior to this most recent wave. There's no, the real solution has to be a political one in which citizenship ends up on the table.
One of the interesting things is that we have China wading in to offer solutions here. When you have a national crisis such as what is happening in Myanmar, it is not often that China wades in to act as peacemaker or you know, sort of interventionist here. Other agencies have said things and have failed. What makes China think that it can do that it can succeed?
I think this is a good question because, in fact, what we see is this diplomatic initiative coming right on the heels of Rex Tillerson's visit, which was a visit that was both offering U.S. humanitarian aid and at the same time calling for investigations into who's responsible for the crisis. China has demonstrated a completely different approach. I think here we have, in terms of the South China Sea, we see a far more aggressive Chinese attitude to the region. But here, this is perhaps an opportunity for the Chinese to see what type of traction this diplomatic initiative gets.
Okay, let us stay with China, saying it's urging Thailand to find Muslim Uyghurs quickly after a cell break.
Yes, this is...
This is fun.
It's a very...
We love a cell break.
Cell break. A lot of excitement here. There was...
It's a very dramatic cell break, exactly. As opposed to a dull one.
There have been a substantial number of Uyghurs in detention in Thailand over the last, I think, since 2015. What we've been finding is that Uyghurs have been using Southeast Asia as a conduit, as a travel route to Turkey. And the Thai government, after a bomb blast, which took place in Bangkok a couple of years ago, after Uyghurs were implicated in that bomb blast, the Thai government engaged in a security sweep which arrested, I think, close to 200 Uyghurs. The Uyghurs themselves claim that they are Turkish citizens. The Chinese claim that they are jihadists. And the Thai government has chosen to side with the Chinese government, and rather than send them to Turkey to repatriate them or to send them back to China, human rights organizations argue that this is going to lead to them being tortured, and the Thai government does not have a good response to this. They view the Uyghurs as an internal security threat, and this is the reason why this crisis is so difficult for them. Both it demonstrates, again, the incapacity perhaps of security forces in Thailand, but also if some of these Uyghurs are not found, it could lead to a small amount of diplomatic embarrassment with China.
Carla Venura from SOAS, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. Italians take pride in their good diet and good weather, and as a result, in their longevity. And now the Italian government has decided to officially incorporate the nation's well-being into the way it sets its budget. It seems that for Italy, the GDP is no longer the only measure of the country's success. Well, Ferdinando Giuliano is economics columnist at Bloomberg View in Rome, and he joins us on Monocle 24 tonight. Ferdinando, explain to us how the Italians measure so-called welfare indicators.
So the Italian government has decided that there are 12 indicators of well-being. Now, this is a range of indicators. They go from income inequality to predatory crime to other things like longevity, life expectancy, or indeed housing, which should not illegal housing, which has to do with the way we treat our landscape. So these are 12 indicators that just been presented, and what the government will do is whenever he will have his annual budget, he will give forecasts of economic growth using gross domestic product, which is the measure everyone uses, but he will also offer forecasts for these 12 indicators, and he will say also how the policies which he will enact, the economic policies he will pass, will change this forecast, not just for GDP growth, but also for these other indicators.
Tell us a little bit about how that will change the way that the Italian productivity or GDP will be measured now, because you're bringing in these new factors that other countries are not.
Well, so the way the economic growth is measured will not change. So economic growth as measured by national income, summing all the output by all the factories and service companies in the country, will not change. What the government will do is to also provide other indicators, other numbers, which will, however, be presented in the official budget document. This is something which is unprecedented and new in the European Union and in the G7. So let's be clear, lots of countries, including the UK, are measuring well-being indicator. David Cameron, the former British Prime Minister, pushed for this agenda, and the Office for National Statistics in the UK does measure other indicators. The OECD, the organization based in Paris, the Club of Mainly Rich Countries, is also has an agenda to measure well-being. However, the Italian government is the first one which will include this forecast in its official budget budget document. That means that when a policy is enacted, well, the consequences for well-being will be forecast and measured there.
This is not a new idea. I think it was the former US presidential candidate Robert Kennedy who says that the gross national product doesn't allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. Why do you think people haven't taken this up as completely as the Italians have done? You've given examples of people who have considered it, but not gone as far as Italy.
Well, because economic growth as measured by national income is a very concise and comparable number. I can tell you quite easily whether Italy is growing faster or slower than Germany or the UK. And that's because we all use the same indicator, measured using the same principles. And that's a very synthetic. It's one number. Economic growth this year would be 2%, would be 1%. The minute we go into well-being indicators, there's a variety of them. Everyone has his favorite one. Some people prefer things which have to do with inequality. Others prefer things which have to do with healthcare. Others with life expectancy. Now, I'm being a little bit, unfair. There are some measures which have been universally accepted. I'll give you one example. It's the Human Development Index, which is widely used across the world, and that combines life expectancy with literacy, with economic growth. And that's the result of the work largely associated with Amartya Sen, a Nobel Prize winner. So there are indicators out there which are comparable, but at the same time, economic growth is such a concise and synthetic indicator that it remains very powerful as a synthesis of our well-being. But as Robert Kennedy said there, well, there is more to well-being than just growth.
And indeed, the Italians are extremely good at well-being. You have food that makes us feel extremely happy. You have places that make us feel extremely happy because they're nice to look at. You have lots of sunshine, and you're a handsome and well-educated lot. Doesn't that give you a slightly unfair advantage over the rest of us poor mortals?
Well, I think that's why we love sharing, let's say, our all the things you've mentioned with others. By welcoming all the tourists who come here. So by all means, people can move here, come here, enjoy our life with us. And, then that way you can bring some of that, as indeed many do, by, cooking better food back home or indeed just enjoying a weekend in the way we do. But obviously, it's something which us Italians are blessed with. We've probably mastered it throughout centuries. And as I said, just come over and enjoy a little bit of that.
Whoever thought that eating a bowl of pasta would contribute to the well-being of a nation? Ferdinando Giuliano, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. My thanks to our producer, Tom Hall, researchers Daphne Karnizes and Alessio Dell'Anna, and our studio manager, Sarah Miles. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time. Tyke Edenright will be your host for that. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you so much for listening.